Hear me, hear me, hear me. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is American Family Insurance Company Appellant versus Auto Owners Insurance Company Appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Ronald Parsons, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. William Fuller, an attorney from Sioux Falls. As you may observe, counsel, this is not the normal bench. We do have a few disqualifications today. The court has appointed the Honorable Sean O'Brien, Circuit Judge from Mitchell, to sit on behalf of Justice Sabers, who's disqualified himself. The court has appointed the Honorable Lori Wilbur, presiding Circuit Judge of the 6th Judicial Circuit, to sit for Justice Zinner. And the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, retired Justice of this court, to sit for Justice Konenkamp. With that, Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, counsel. This is a contest between insurance companies, and it's also one of those refreshing cases where the facts are undisputed and the parties have stipulated to them, so the parties in this court can focus on some interesting questions of law. The first question is, should this court create essentially a public policy rule establishing that a commercial or a residential tenant must be treated as a co-insured under a landlord's insurance policy as a matter of law in order to prevent the landlord's insurer from seeking subrogation from the tenant or the tenant's insurer? The trial court here said yes, and I represent American Family, and we respectfully believe that the answer should be no. And the second question is, does the lease in the present action contain anything that would suggest to the tenants that they're not liable for their damage for damage resulting from their negligence, including a negligently caused fire, or anything to suggest that they could rely on the landlord to purchase fire insurance that the tenant then could take advantage of. And again, the trial court believed that it did, and we respectfully believe that the plain language of the lease here speaks for itself. Now, regarding the first question of law, as I'm sure the court knows, there are three approaches, each of which has drawn judicial support, and only one of which, however, would preclude a subrogation claim in the present action. The Sutton rule has been adopted by courts in approximately 14 states, and there's some debate about a couple of states. And under the Sutton rule, every tenant is deemed to be a co-insured under its landlord's insurance policy as a matter of law, absent an express agreement between the parties to the contrary. And the Sutton rationale was initially enacted by the Oklahoma Court of Appeals in 1975 on the basis that the landlord-tenant situation is comparable to a permissive user of an automobile. But subsequent courts, I think, have kind of dispelled that rationale, pointing out that an auto or a permissive user is considered an insured under an auto policy because the definition of insured includes permissive users. Now, courts in at least 10 jurisdictions have expressly adopted what I call the default rule. And seven of those 10 jurisdictions have done so post-Sutton, in other words, since Sutton came out. And the default rule enforces subrogation rights in the landlord-tenant context just as they are enforced in any other context, holding people responsible for their negligent acts and allowing subrogation if there's a contractual or an equitable right to obtain subrogation. So it holds that people are responsible for their negligent acts and subject to subrogation unless there's an agreement releasing them from that obligation. So it's kind of the reverse of the Sutton rule. There has to be an express exemption from subrogation. And I would suggest that presumably has been the default rule up until now in South Dakota. Prior to the trial court's decision here, subrogation has not been precluded. The question apparently has never reached this court, but you presumably have been able to obtain subrogation against a tenant, or in this case, a tenant's insurer. And that reflects South Dakota's general statutory public policy that's been established by the legislature in our general negligence statute, 20-9-1, and specifically for tenants in SDCL 43-3210, which holds that lessees are liable for all deteriorations or damage to the leased premises that are occasioned by their negligence or willful or malicious conduct.
Did the trial court address those statutes?
Trial court did not address those statutes.
Was the argument presented?
No, the argument was not presented to the trial court regarding those statutes. It's something that I located in preparing for this appeal. But the central argument, I believe, was made and preserved. That South Dakota public policy allowed for subrogation. So the default rule places all of us on the same footing and simply leaves the existing law of subrogation in South Dakota just as it is. And the purpose of subrogation is to ultimately place the loss on the wrongdoers who are responsible for causing the damage. And so the default rule enforces South Dakota's general public policy. In the absence of a special rule adopted by this court today, American Family would be entitled to subrogation under the auto owner's policy because it's contractually entitled to stand in the landlord's shoes, Mr. Babinski's shoes, in order to recover the damages caused by the tenant's undisputed negligence.
Does that allow the whole liability or the whole responsibility of the landlord then to be transferred to the renter? As far as, I mean, can they by agreement say, we're not going to insure any of this, it's all your responsibility as a renter?
Well, I think the renter could only have to be held responsible for insuring that part of the premises for which it is responsible. In other words, a landlord couldn't force a tenant to buy general property insurance that would insure against a fire that was not caused by the tenant's negligence. All that I think a landlord could reasonably do, and maybe even legally do, is require, as it is done here, a tenant to purchase personal property insurance and then liability insurance, which specifically covers damage resulting from the tenant's negligence.
Wouldn't there have to be some a dollar amount that would have to be discussed then prior or part of the lease that you need to insure up to $1 million or $5 million or whatever the complex is worth? I mean, how are you going to know how much insurance to purchase?
Well, I think that it would depend on the circumstances. Here we have a house. It was a duplex, a brick duplex house, and the fire essentially mostly damaged just that part of the house that the tenant was occupying. So the tenant did have enough insurance to cover this loss and was told to purchase insurance to cover this type of loss.
Well, you read a statute that said that the tenant is responsible for damage to the leasehold. Say that this was a complex of 40 apartments, and they put the hot coals in the closet, burns the whole place down. Is, under that statute, the tenant liable only for their apartment's damage or the whole building?
I think under the plain language of the statute, I take that back. It would depend upon the definition of premises that's assigned that statute's construed. The statute says you have to be responsible for damages to the premises. So presumably the premises might only include that part that was rented by the insured. And I think these types of situations...
So we still have to go back to the fallback question then of the Sutton Doctrine for all the rest of the building.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that's a different situation, and that's why the contract approach, I think, is the best approach, as many courts have recognized, and I would suggest a majority. Here, we don't have that situation. In a situation in which there is, a 40-unit apartment building, that's admittedly a very different situation. Obviously, an insurer is not going to bring an action for a $20 million building against a judgment-proof tenant, so I think it's unlikely that situation would really arise. Then again, if it's a commercial tenant who has the means and whose negligence or reckless or willful conduct even causes the destruction of the entire building, I think, as with any situation, you're responsible for your negligent actions, no matter what the scope of that is. And so I think the contract approach has been adopted. It's been adopted by my count 17 states, all of which are post-Sutton decisions, and which make up most of the largest states in the country.
Do those contract cases discuss the uneven playing field between a rentor and a landlord?
They do, and they focus on two factors. And it arises from the Eighth Circuit's decision in General Mills versus Goldman. And in that decision, the Eighth Circuit said that because the lease contained a clause that exonerates tenants from damages resulting from fire, an action could not be brought against the tenants. And so the courts that apply the contract approach look for two things. Is there anything that would exonerate the tenant from responsibility for damages resulting from fire, or negligence generally, a negligently caused fire? Or is there anything in the lease that obligates the landlord to purchase fire insurance or indicates to the tenant, under the plain language, that the landlord is going to be purchasing fire insurance, so the tenant can be said to be able to rely on that representation? And so,
you use the word fire insurance, but in this lease agreement, it was liability insurance. Is there a difference?
Well, I don't think so, and I'm not sure you can, and I may be wrong, I'm not sure you can even really buy just fire insurance anymore. Usually you buy a property insurance that includes liability coverage. I meant that exempts them from their negligence.
These jurisdictions that have gone into the theory on contract, are they addressing at all the fact that leases are generally contracts of adhesion drafted by the landlord and given to the proposed tenant on a take-it-or-leave-it basis?
They do. I think that argument has been considered and made in most of the cases. I think there's really nothing distinguishing a lease from a contract of insurance or anything else. I mean, the law still requires that we interpret them according to their plain language. Now, if there are ambiguous terms regarding these issues, then that would be construed against the landlord who drafted the lease. But I don't think there's a general protective policy among the courts, other than the Sutton courts, that take that type of proactive approach. I think it's considered, but I think ultimately the language of the lease controls. And these courts have emphasized that if the legislature wants to enact this type of exemption, then that's where the exemption should be enacted. I think there are several other reasons why the Sutton rule is preferable. Primarily, the Sutton decisions rely upon equity. And equity is inherently situational. The very concept of equity to me seems to mean that you look at the realities, you look at the underlying facts, you consider all of the differences. And here the trial court imposed a blanket equitable rule, and that seems to me kind of to be an oxymoron. Here there's an incontrovertible rule based on equity that says don't look at the underlying facts, don't look at the circumstances, this is just the way it is. And I would suggest that if you really look at the true equities of this situation, here you have two insurance companies on this risk. And the question is, which insurance company should pay? That's when you cut away all the legalities and look at the equities. The question is, which insurer should pay? Should it be the insurer of the landlord who was not responsible for causing the loss, or should it be the insurer of the tenant who sold an insurance policy specifically to cover this loss, accepted premiums in order to cover this loss, and now is trying to hide behind the tenant and say, well, you should consider the tenant to be co-insured on that other policy so we don't have to pay under the policy we sold.
Assuming that, go back to my 40-unit example, if the place burns down and the damage is well in excess of the tenant's limits, can you go after the tenant for the balance?
Well, I think you should look at, that'd be a different circumstance. You should look at the equities of that situation. That might not be equitable to do so. But here, and that's why the contract approach to me seems to be more advisable, because you can consider all of the factors. And under the Sutton rule, you don't consider any of the factors. You just can't get subrogation against a negligent tenant's insurer. And that to me seems inequitable.
Do we know why the tenant procured the insurance? Was it based upon that lease agreement?
Yes. Absolutely, I think. I think the stipulated facts address that, but the lease agreement required them to purchase insurance, liability insurance, and required that they produce it prior to taking occupancy. And they were aware of that, and that's why they went out and bought insurance.
I understand that they occupied it about a month before the insurance took effect. Is that correct?
I didn't know that. I'm not sure.
I might be wrong.
Yeah. If that's true, I wasn't aware of that. The other thing that courts look at under the contract, the flexible approach, is the reasonable expectation of the parties. And I think the Sutton rule is based on really a false premise that the reasonable expectation of the parties are just identical in every situation. I just think that's never true. And if you look at what is the reasonable expectation of a tenant in South Dakota, I don't think it's a tenant's reasonable expectation that if they get drunk holding a cigarette in their hand and fall asleep and burn down their apartment, that they have no liability or responsibility whatsoever. I just really don't think that's a reasonable expectation. Now, it's certainly a reasonable expectation of a tenant that if their apartment burns down and it wasn't their fault, it wasn't caused by their direct negligence, they're not responsible, and that's the law, and that's how it should be. There's really no other situation that I could think of. I put some thought on it. I couldn't think of another situation where a court is saying that there's a category of people who aren't responsible for their negligence, for the consequences of their negligence in certain situations. Legislatures do it, but I couldn't think of another situation where a court does. So I think the court should be hesitant to alter that principle on the basis of public policy reasons. The other thing is, if you take insurance out of the equation, Mr. Babinski has an entire right to bring an action against Ashley Dice, the negligent tenant. So he could recover against her for all of the damages. And even in a situation in which there is a person who owns a 40-unit building and one of his tenants causes a fire that burns down the entire building, under common law, the person, you could bring an action and recover for that entire liability against a negligent tenant. The only thing, there's no reason to me, it seems, that the presence of insurance should change that reality. I mean, the tenant might be judgment-proof in that situation, but the landlord could bring his own action against the tenant. Nothing would stop it. The Sutton rule intervenes only to protect insurance companies, I would suggest, or the situation in which there is insurance. And so it just doesn't make logical sense to me that if Babinski could recover against Ashley Dice, American Family, which has the right to stand in Babinski's shoes, can't recover against Ashley Dice's insurer, who sold a policy to insure that very risk. I would also then suggest that the public policy reasons that have been identified by the trial court don't override the general principles of subrogation that this court has enforced. Certainty was the other one, and gamesmanship was the other. Now, to me, certainty shouldn't be sublimated to what is the right result, what is the correct principle of law. And there's nothing less certain about the default rule. The default rule provides just as much certainty. You are subject to subrogation just like anyone else unless there's an express exemption from it.
So subrogation, though, is an equitable remedy, isn't it?
It's both. It's a contractual remedy and an equitable remedy. So we have some contractual rights to consider here.
So how do we do that with both of it? If it's both equitable and contract, how do the courts apply it then?
Well, I think contract rights should be enforced unless the legislature has altered them.
So where does the equitable part come in?
Well, I think in a case where there may not be a contractual right to subrogation, then you would focus solely on the equities. And this court's recognized that an insurer can obtain a subrogation from a negligent party, a negligent third party, on the basis of equity alone. But here we have a contractual subrogation right. American Family has contractual right to stand in Babinski's shoes. And so all of Babinski's rights under his insurance contract are transferred or recorded to American Family. So since Babinski would have the right to go against Ashley Dice, American Family should have the right to go against Ashley Dice's insurer.
But it also depends upon the agreement in the lease. Is that what you're saying?
Under the contract approach, yes. Mm-hmm. Under the default approach, you just enforce the doctrine of subrogation.
So which one are you purporting?
Well, my main thing is we shouldn't adopt the Sutton rule. I would be happy with either situation. I can understand the contract approach.
Would that be more stable as far as being able to predict what the rights are in the subrogation?
I think
the party's rights and the insurance company's ability to write the risk, and which would be the most...
I think the default rule would be the most stable. The contract rule might be a little more equitable. But either rule is more preferable, I think, to just immunity from subrogation for insurers of risks.
Can you help me understand the difference between the default rule and the case-by-case?
The default rule just is basically no rule. The court doesn't have a rule other than you're entitled to subrogation. Unless there's something that expressly waives that right. Like a landlord says, I will not go against my tenant for subrogation.
You basically have to do a case-by-case analysis to determine whether you've got, whether that's applicable.
Sounds the same to me. Yeah, they're kind of the same. You would have to just see if there's a specific exemption from subrogation. Under the contract principle, you look at other factors, like if there is a waiver of liability, a waiver from responsibility, an exoneration clause like in Goldman, or if the lease agreement requires the purchase of fire insurance by the landlord.
Your time has expired, Mr. Parsons. Thank you. Mr. Fuller, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bill Fuller, and it's my privilege to represent Sandra Pike, Chris Pike, Ashley Deese, and auto owners in this matter. This is a case of first impression in the state of South Dakota, and it's a case arising from the concepts of equity. Subrogation in South Dakota is not unique to South Dakota. The concepts that have come from this court on subrogation are similar to the concepts in Nebraska, which has adopted the Sutton Rule, in Minnesota, which has adopted the Sutton Rule, in North Dakota, which has adopted the Sutton Rule. And basically, insurance policies do not alter the fundamental principles pertaining to subrogation. And this language comes from the MetLife decision, Justice Meyer Henry, in which she pointed out that subrogation arises from equity. The underlying principle is equity and subrogation. This is not about tenant immunity. This is not a case proposing tenant immunity. This is a case about subrogation between insurance companies. All the cases that have been cited to the court that are pro-Sutton cases, in all the cases that have been cited to the court that have ruled in favor of the tenants, which are the majority of them, on a case-by-case approach, all of those cases do not have statutes that have been passed by the legislature as advocated by American Family, in which the legislature is supposed to say that the landlord cannot subrogate against the insurance company of the tenant. The issue here is subrogation as it relates to the insurer for the landlord and subrogation as it relates to the insurance available to the tenant. And between the two, where should that loss fall? The Sutton Rule provides the legal certainty that we're all searching for. The Sutton Rule makes it clear to all, to the landlords and to the insurance companies and even to the tenants, that if there is a loss, a fire loss, that loss is borne by the insurance company for the landlord. It provides consistency, it provides certainty, And the courts that have adopted that rule, that's one of the reasons they have adopted that rule.
Is it fair, though?
Yes, it is fair, because the insurance companies that write that risk, by necessity, take into consideration the inherent risk of a fire loss. And I don't think that that risk is quantified or measured by a particular tenant in a particular unit. The insurer or the landlord has embraced that risk, has analyzed it, has underwritten it. And so, yes, I think it is fair.
Are you suggesting that since subrogation is equitable, that the legislature would not have authority to legislate in this area if it so chose?
To legislate in what particular regard?
I'll just say if we adopt the Sutton Doctrine next year, the legislature says no, it's repealed.
Well, I've never been able to totally anticipate what the legislature may do here in South Dakota, but I think the Sutton Doctrine is a case law doctrine that has been developed by case law over the years in many jurisdictions. I'm aware, and I'm sure the court is aware, of certain statutes passed by the legislature which have been in reaction to case law decisions from the South Dakota Supreme Court, so I cannot guarantee that, Your Honor. My prognosis is no, that will not happen.
But I guess my question, I should have asked a little better, do they have the constitutional authority, if this is an equitable doctrine, to override it by a statute?
I honestly don't know. I don't know whether they have the constitutional authority to do that or not.
Because clearly they've regulated in a lot of areas of insurance, and now they have a landlord-tenant code that we go by too, but I was just trying to wonder about that.
It's a good question. I'm sorry I don't have a specific answer for you on that.
Okay.
The Sutton Doctrine has been adopted by our count and our brief by 16 separate jurisdictions, including North Dakota, Minnesota, and Nebraska. And besides providing the legal certainty that I was talking about, the Sutton Doctrine does allow for the landlord and the tenant to separately negotiate a lease, providing for subrogation back against the tenant. The Sutton Doctrine does not prohibit that or preclude that. That is still available as far as negotiation between a landlord and a tenant. As a practical matter, I don't know if there is really much negotiation that goes on between a landlord and a tenant other than perhaps how much rent you pay per month. But that option is available to the insurer for the landlord and to the landlord himself.
Isn't that the case here?
Your Honor, I don't think so. This lease, in this particular case, basically exonerates the landlord from any liability. Under the non-liability of lessor clause in the lease, the tenant cannot sue the landlord for personal injury. If there's bad wiring in the premises, under the terms of the lease, the tenant cannot sue the landlord if the premises burn down and the landlord or the tenant is injured or a guest is injured. It's a one-sided contract of adhesion. And so I don't think there was negotiation going on here in this particular case. In one of the cases that American Family has heavily relied upon is the Rouse decision from the state of Maryland. And American Family has cited that numerous times in its brief. But even in that case, which is relied upon by American Family, the Maryland appellate court said that there are two caveats in deciding whether subrogation claims against tenants are against public policy. And the first caveat is whether the lease is unfair or one-sided or a contract of adhesion. And the second caveat is whether the lease specifically provides that the landlord's insurer can subrogate against the tenant. If that's not in the lease, then it's not enforceable. And this is the case that was relied upon by American Family. In this particular case, the lease is one-sided. The lease is unfair. And more importantly, the lease does not make known to the tenant that the insurance company or the landlord is going to come back against the tenant in case there is a fire loss. This lease talks about the tenant procuring or getting personal property insurance. It doesn't tell the tenant to get fire insurance, but to get insurance on the tenant's own personal property. And in the lease agreement, the lease is written in such a way that the landlord is exonerated from any loss of personal property to the tenant in the first place. The lease requires liability insurance. It does not require fire insurance.
Tell me the difference.
Well, the difference is fire insurance is property insurance. Liability insurance, as I see it in this particular case and many other cases, deals with third-party claims against either the tenant or the landlord, such as...
But doesn't liability insurance include negligence?
Liability insurance includes negligence.
Whether it starts a fire or whether somebody falls or whatever. So maybe it's me. I see a distinction without a difference.
Well, in the case of liability insurance, the courts, when they address the point that you raised, Justice Miller, they talk about the reasonable expectation of the tenant is claims by third parties. And in the lease agreement, the lease itself talks about the acts of third parties. Right under the provision dealing with the tenant obligated to obtain liability insurance, the very next provision under the lease agreement talks about the acts of third parties. And the lease does not require a specific amount for the liability insurance. The American Family policy indicates that each building had a replacement cost of, I believe, $281,000. I think the liability limits here with auto owners was only $100,000. There's no correlation between the fire loss and the liability insurance requirement in the lease. And so when they talk about liability insurance, they're talking about claims brought by third parties such as other guests or family members or invitees on the property that get hurt or injured. The lease, the landlord certainly can draft the lease to make it clear to all involved that you are required to get fire insurance on the property, that if there is a loss, and the landlord's insurance company is going to enforce its rights of subrogation. It's going to come back against you and your insurance company. That easily can be made part of the lease provisions and made known to the tenant. I don't think tenants know about subrogation. I don't think a lot of attorneys know about subrogation. It's an area by itself. And to expect lay people to enter into a lease agreement, and then there's a fire loss, and all of a sudden the landlord's insurance company comes back against you, I think that's unreasonable, and the courts agree. So here in the Babinski lease, incidentally, Babinski owned six separate buildings, I think 12 units altogether, each building worth $280,000, with a leasing agent out of Minneapolis, I think the reasonable expectation of a tenant, certainly in that case and in most cases, is with an investment of that size and scope, the landlord's going to have insurance on the property to protect the investment. And if there's a loss, the landlord's insurance company is going to pay for the fire loss.
Do you think the tenants understand the extent of the ownership of the landlord any more than they understand or appreciate the extent of subrogation or lack thereof?
I doubt it, Your Honor, but I think
that really isn't a fair argument, is it?
Well, it's not a it has some relevance in the commercial world, not in this particular case, but in many cases.
Okay, that's fair.
In this particular case, as I indicated, the lease agreement exonerates the landlord from any type of tort liability. I don't know, I would highly doubt that that's enforceable, but that's what the lease says. In that particular situation, I think it's obviously unfair, and a contract of adhesion, and under the Rausch decision, that's one indication that the landlord's insurance company cannot subrogate. And also, in the lease agreement, it does not indicate that the landlord's insurance company is going to pursue subrogation against the tenant's insurance company or the tenant. And that's the second part, the second caveat of the Rausch decision, which was cited by American Family. So in this particular case, the liability insurance, I think, presents or offers to the landlord another layer of liability protection. The landlord first protects himself by saying in the lease, you can't sue me. And second thing the landlord says in the lease is, and also you have to get liability coverage. And so if there is any type of claim against the tenant and the landlord or either one, an extra layer of liability coverage is available to protect the landlord. This case is not a departure from the principles of subrogation. This is, although this is a case of first impression here in South Dakota, South Dakota and Judge Surska and hopefully this court is not by itself. 16 jurisdictions have adopted Sutton and 3 neighboring states have adopted Sutton. And so you're not by yourself. You're not on an island in this particular instance. In Nebraska, the UREN decision, U-R-E-N, dealt with a lease very similar to the lease that we're dealing here in this particular case. And the Nebraska Supreme Court held in that particular case that the liability insurance was for protection against third parties, just the point you raised, Justice Miller. And it was really... that was the intent and the purpose of that lease requirement to obtain liability insurance. And in TRIPAR, which is out of Nebraska, the same holding. And finally, Bregman out of Minnesota, the same holding. I think Uran may have been out of North Dakota and not Nebraska. I may have misspoke on that. So in this particular case, the lease, by its terms, is unfair, is a contract of adhesion. The lease does not alert the tenant that subrogation is going to come back against them by the insurer of the landlord. The lease is unfair and one-sided, and the Sutton rule obviates all of these issues. The beauty of the Sutton rule is each case is guided by the rule of Sutton as opposed to having a separate and distinct case-by-case analysis. But even if you want to employ a case-by-case analysis in this particular case and not follow the Sutton rule, just as Judge Surska held, even if you apply the case-by-case analysis, in this particular case, American Family cannot subrogate against auto owners or the tenants. And for all of those reasons, Your Honors, I would ask that the court affirm Judge Surska's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I think an important principle to underline is that the lease makes the tenants fully aware that they are responsible for the damages resulting from their negligence. And so I think that it's kind of a an inaccurate or a false argument to say that, well, tenants don't understand that that will be brought in subrogation. I mean, a tenant knows that he or she is fully responsible for all of the consequences resulting from negligent acts. Now, whether it's the landlord bringing the action or the landlord's insurer, substantively is irrelevant to the tenant. The question is the tenant responsible? I wanted to address...
Mr. Fuller says that he thinks that only applies to liability against third parties as opposed to the tenant. What's your response to that?
I respectfully disagree with that. The liability insurance is to protect yourself against your negligence, as you observed, Your Honor. The liability policy in this case is clearly defined. It's in the record. It's a personal liability policy purchased by the tenants on record, page 55. On page 13, it says, we will pay all sums any insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of or arising out of bodily injury or property damage caused by an occurrence to which this coverage applies. An occurrence means an accident that results in bodily injury or property damage. So liability policy insures against your liability, not only for other people, but for all people. In this case, the lease is absolutely clear, and if there are terms in that lease that are not enforceable, then they're not enforceable. But those terms are not at issue here. I mean, an exculpation of the landlord from his own liability would not be enforceable. But that's not at issue in this case. Here, the lease expressly provides multiple times, with multiple signatures and initials, that the tenants would be responsible at their own cost for any and all damage done to any part of the premises. Section E2B expressly provides that the tenants are required to reimburse the landlord for any loss or property damage caused as a result of their negligence. It does not in any way exempt or exclude negligently caused fires from that contractual obligation. It does not in any way obligate the landlord to purchase fire insurance, or say the landlord has fire insurance, or say fires are accepted from this, or say you can rely on the landlord for damages caused by your negligently caused fires. It says the opposite. It says you are responsible for your negligence. And that's not a contract of adhesion or unfair terms. That's the law of South Dakota. I mean, even if these provisions weren't in there, that would be true under statute and under common law. So there's nothing unusual about the situation of an insurer standing in the shoes, as it has the contractual right to do, of the landlord and obtaining the same damages that the landlord indisputably could obtain. To me, it doesn't make sense to create an equitable rule protecting a tenant's insurer in those situations. And I thought your question was interesting, Chief Justice Gilbertson, about could the legislature get involved here? I think they absolutely could. And this court in the Made Whole Doctrine cases, Roe and Lester, people have advanced equitable arguments to this court, saying we would like you to apply a rule of equity saying you can't enforce your contractual right of subrogation unless the insured is made whole. And this court has said we defer to the legislature's judgment in those types of situations, and if that should be the rule, then the legislature should enact it. And I think the same is true for the equitable aspects sought to be enforced under the Sutton rule. You know, the Tripar case is interesting. That was auto owners seeking subrogation against a tenant. And there it was just against a tenant. But here, it's against the tenant's insurer. And so I think that's a different situation. But I think this is just a case in which the Nebraska court got it wrong, and the courts in New York and California and Texas and Florida and Illinois and Ohio and Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Colorado and Indiana and Arizona and North Dakota and Iowa have got it right. We should look at the contracts, and we should look at the responsibility to pay for damages caused by one's negligence and the insurer's responsibility to pay under the policy itself to negligent tenants. So I would very respectfully suggest that if there is going to be an immunity for subrogation against negligent tenants, and their insurers that that immunity should be anchored in a policymaking choice by the legislature, consumer protection type of act, or in the plain language of a lease agreement between the parties. And there's nothing in the lease agreement that provides any notice or any indication that a tenant or his insurer is not going to be responsible for negligently causing a fire. So very respectfully, I know there's good arguments on both sides of this case. We wouldn't be here if there weren't. But I respectfully suggest that it's more preferable to decline to adopt the Sutton rule. At least look at individual cases. At least allow the facts to affect equity. And so we ask that the court reverse the grant of summary judgment in favor of auto owners and instead direct the trial court to enter summary judgment in favor of the American family in these circumstances.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.